Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
I'm just so proud of Jeremy Corbyn. He becomes more memeable by the day, and he goes on the cover of GQ in an M&S suit that is mid-range and fits him just not particularly well, in that sort of slightly weird old dad who bought a suit 30 years ago and has sort of slightly shriveled, and it's still good.
A few years of wearing
exactly. And I have so many problems with the Labour Party. Obviously, social democracy is like structurally ill-equipped to totally like liberate like the working class, and it articulates itself on the level of the nation state. And New Labour was just a hot mess in so many ways, especially on the question of migration. But I just want Jeremy to be happy. I'm so proud of him, and the way that he has absolutely no idea what's happened in his life for the last 2 years. He thought he was just gonna sort of like fade into like twinkly jam granddad
socialist obscurity,
and suddenly he's the poster boy for the global radical left, and loads of like young men whose interests include like football, Tisky, Gramsci, and like the Sesh.
I don't understand what two of those words meant, but continue.
We'll pick up on which two later, but are so like emotionally invested in this incredibly, incredibly genteel old style social democrat vision of masculinity, and I applaud that, and which is wonderful because like the Ian Hislops of this world have absolutely no idea what's going on, yeah. Because they don't quite realise that even though like the man himself is so sincere that there are sort of 1500 levels of irony that are allowing people to like emotionally engage with the idea that this person is the vanguard.
Do you think Jeremy Corbyn quite knows why?
Oh, I think he's sort of like politely confused about the whole thing and just sort of slightly pleased about it. I don't know. I'm so proud of him.
That's what I want to believe anyway. He might not understand what's happening, but he's really polite to the young people who do it for him.
Exactly. Which is why, you know, I just want to give him a cuddle and maybe send him a pair of knitted socks for Christmas. No. Maybe I'll have to learn to knit beforehand. But
anyway.
I could acquire skills. I mean, I'm getting off track here.
So, welcome to the Sisterhood podcast, and today we are talking about various kinds of frozen fruit. It is the free speech episode, and we're going to be talking about trigger warnings, we're going to be talking about the nature of freedom in speech and debate, and this is obviously a huge topic that gets into some deep, messy philosophical stuff, and people have spent entire careers trying to work out what free speech is, and we're going to do it in half an hour, and I'm feeling confident. Are you feeling confident?
I'm feeling confident. I was born ready.
Fantastic. So, in that case, my question to you, Els, is what is free speech?
That's outrageous. I can't believe you just asked me to... Right, so I think one of the things is that we need to be very, very clear on the fact that a right in its basic form is a legal thing, essentially.
Yeah.
It's, and rights are about protecting the individual from... the vicissitudes of potentially corrupt governments. Like, that was what they were set up for. So in basic broad strokes, the right to free speech is the something that enshrines the fact that you can say within certain boundaries what you want and the government can't punish you for that. But because the language of rights has sort of detached itself from its original legal, juridical meaning and taken on this sort of, like, cultural nebulous formation that's kind of this ever increasing uncontrollable blob monster that just dominates all of debate, becomes like a meta debate about what you're allowed to say.
Yes.
This massively confuses things. So what free speech has become on certain corners of the internet, and therefore, you know, and thereby sort of certain, like, now very mainstream political circles, is I can say what I want, no matter what the consequences are.
Yeah.
But those consequences are not allowed to return to me, aka I have the right to say anything, and you can't complain about it.
And if you do complain about it, you're the real fascist. That's what gets me.
Exactly.
Any kind of criticism is repurposed as sort of proto-fascist, proto or proto-Stalinist, or whatever those people kind of think is the worst thing. And it becomes, like you've just said, a proxy debate about whether it's okay to be racist, basically. That is it okay for me to say this thing? No, it has to be okay for me to say this awful thing, because if you criticize me or take my argument apart, you are infringing on my right to free speech, and therefore, weren't you the real Nazi all along?
But it's a genius rhetorical move, right? Mm-hmm. Because what it does is it shifts the debate from the content of the speech onto the form of the speech, onto like the very act of speaking. And it's so rigorously stupid. This is the thing that fascinates. It's so dunderheaded, because the idea that criticizing someone's free speech is not in itself free speech, it's just, it's so damn myopic, obviously.
Yeah.
Because and it goes against these sort of, you know, rarefied liberal values that a lot of, you know, proponents of free speech pretend to claim. It's like the idea of debate, the idea that things should be able to hold their own in the marketplace of ideas. Well, if that's right, we should be allowed to challenge people without being called like cucks and snowflakes or whatever.
It turns out the free marketplace of ideas is a monopoly.
Exactly.
Ooh,
it's about it's a marketplace like any other, aka some people get profoundly screwed over and some people aren't allowed in anyway.
Yeah, aka not really free at all.
Exactly.
So what I find interesting as well about the way free speech is used, particularly all around the world, because obviously in the UK, in Europe, we don't have this vaunted Second Amendment that they have in the USA.
Although some people like to think that we do, which is
yes, weird. No, it's that we're not Americans. We don't have that. We don't even have a constitution.
You've just been watching too much TV.
Absolutely. No, I watch Hamilton. It makes me really proud to be an American citizen. No, hang on, wait.
Wait a second.
But the idea that people who say these reactionary, awful things somehow are themselves, they are the free speech fighters, they're the freedom fighters. It allows them to rephrase and repackage their boring, reactionary, racist ideas as somehow, you know, a great challenge to the status quo. You know, they're the real rebels, they're the real heroes, as long as we don't focus too hard on what it is they've actually said.
Yeah, and the fact that what they've actually said is just a sort of lazy repackaging of social realities that have existed for many hundreds of years. Like, this is, it's impressive, right? It's really genuinely impressive that these people have somehow managed to persuade, like, a lot of the mainstream press that like racism is some kind of fringe idea rather than a logic underpinning the entire world economic system.
Yeah. So, oh, you're not allowed to say this stuff anymore apart from on the front page of the Daily Mail every single day. Who's not allowing you to say this thing? And does not allowing mean just like we've told you that sounds a bit racist?
No, this is my absolute favourite genre of spicy hot take, is that when people take to their nationally syndicated columns to talk about how they're being silenced.
Oh, God.
Like, it's pure ideology. Hook it straight into my central nervous system. I love it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I think it's quite a nice place here to talk about trigger warnings and talk about the way that idea is deliberately, willfully misunderstood to paint, at the same time as that people are trying to paint reactionary ideas as rebellious, they're also trying to rephrase actual resistance and actual radicalism as somehow
as reactionary.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's no accident that the real focus when we talk about trigger warnings is on students and all these, you know, these rebellious students, because the image of the rebellious student is quite powerful in culture. And particularly since the 60s, and a lot of the people forming culture and in public discourse today would have gone through that radical 60s time, and they understand that, you know, students can be radical, they can be left wing, but it's very important that these students today, they're not allowed to be radical because they're saying things that are a bit too progressive for people in the mainstream politics today. So they must be rephrased as somehow they're censorious, they don't want to be taught.
And there's this sort of generational divide, right? Mm-hmm. Because the assumption of people who maybe once were radical in the 70s and are now sort of centrist liberals is that drifting towards the centre is a condition of aging and becoming, you know, more mature, for instance.
Yeah.
Well, actually it's just a material condition, right?
Yes.
You know, for like, you know, our generation, when people are facing the prospect of never being able to afford a house or kids, being on a really terrible wage for the rest of their lives, like, what reason do they have to drift towards the centre?
No reason.
Absolutely none. Like, what offer is that? This is just like a particular demographic shift, right? And it's transposed onto like a condition of youth that means that like expressions of trigger warnings are just these sort of unrarefied cry of just, yeah.
But it's interesting. So I And I'm going to do a bit of internet history here.
Okey-dokey. Right.
So back in the day on the internet, when we had to hand crank the internet into the internet existing in one room of a house that you had to go to, you had to go to the room where the internet was.
Wow.
Yeah, that's actually, Andrew O'Neill says this in his recent show, is that the experience of having to go to a room to get the internet, and there was only one box that the internet came in, you probably don't remember that.
I'm really sorry, I actually don't remember that.
That's probably because I was always in that room.
True.
But back in the day of the internet, there was a wonderful thing called LiveJournal, which you were just a little bit too young for. But on LiveJournal, for me, that's really where the trigger warning conversation began. And way before people were talking about trigger warnings in the mainstream press, I was used to trigger warnings being used as just a form, a way of formatting our posts and a way of saying, look, this post might contain some content that is triggering to people with PTSD. Because it was LiveJournal, we all talked about all our problems all the time.
Yeah.
And we were all 19 years old and had terrible trauma to write about. But we would still post it. We'd sometimes post it under a cut and just say, look, you may want to read this, you might not. Actually, personally, I sometimes use trigger warnings when I didn't really need to, because I would be able to write something like, trigger warning, this has sex and violence and all kinds of exciting stuff, and you might not want to read it. It's a bit going to be a bit racy. And then, of course, everyone would read it.
Yeah.
That's the other use of trigger warnings. But now people are so obsessed with this idea that students in particular are wanting trigger warnings put on everything. And I swear to God, I've read so many more articles and listened to so many more debates about why trigger warnings are bad than I have actually encountered trigger warnings in real life in academic situations. It's just such a cooked up fake thing.
Yeah, because it cleaves to quite a reactionary propaganda style of talking about the of like locating the problems with unfreedom in individuals not adequately signing up to like a certain set of liberal values of
yeah.
rarefied discourse. And of course people in parliament, and of course men who went to Eton and then Oxbridge have like a particularly narrow idea of like what acceptable academic and public discourse looks like. It's the bloodless cut and thrust of the debating chamber where no one has anything to lose because they've got nothing really at stake.
Yeah,
here.
No one has skin in the game. They're talking about abstract ideas, not people's real lives in the academy.
Yeah, and the whole point of the cultural conversation about trigger warnings, slightly removed from its perhaps original use as a strictly as a term that's strictly related to PTSD,
yeah.
is about calling attention to the fact that when we're having these cultural conversations, people's lives are genuinely at stake, and
yeah.
there is and the trauma that people are pointing to is not some condition of immaturity. It's actually a structural thing. Like some people have to encounter trauma in a political sense just every day because of the way that our society is structured, and the idea of a trigger warning is to call attention to that.
Absolutely.
As well as to be able to give people a little bit of space. It's just about saying, hey, take a breath. Like don't not engage with it, but just take a moment, collect yourself so that you can engage with it. And
yeah.
like the idea that the people who are demanding trigger warnings are able to isolate themselves from these traumas completely misses the point.
Absolutely.
Right? Because the idea that women are snowflakes for wanting trigger warnings of, say, scenes of sexual violence is does a massive disservice to the fact that it's actually incredibly, it requires an incredible amount of courage, I think,
yes.
to go about your life knowing very clearly that everywhere, on public transport, at home, in the office, every day, you are encountering the possibility of sexual violence.
Absolutely.
That's not being a snowflake. That's being a bloody hero.
Yes, absolutely. And this idea as well, I think it's really important to counter the notion that trigger warnings are about censorship. They're not about censorship. A trigger warning has never, in my experience, been about saying, we should not read this, we should not encounter this. It's just a different way of calling attention to content in a text. It's a different way of critically engaging with the text. It's not saying we won't have this, it's saying we will have this, and we'll make it more accessible to all kinds of different people, and we'll acknowledge and be mindful that people encountering this text or this play or whatever are going to come from different backgrounds.
And I don't think that this phenomenon is completely illegible to the people complaining about trigger warnings, mm-hmm. right? I think that's precisely what appears so threatening about it, because it's bound up with an expansion of who is allowed into the public discourse. And you can just see this so transparently with this double-handed movement legislatively by the UK government very recently, where you have, on one hand, a crackdown on things like A, trigger warnings in universities, and B, people using no platform tactics to stop like really reactionary, potentially dangerous speakers coming into their spaces, whilst they're also rolling out programs like Prevent, which regularly target Muslims and students of colour for things like free speech on the Israel-Palestine question. And so what that is, it's not about protecting, you know, free speech as a genuinely democratic ideal. It's protecting a certain kind of speech emanating from a certain kind of person, aka speech largely from white people, which is, you know, coheres with the broad goals and policy priorities of the government.
Absolutely. And it's beyond hypocrisy that in the same month that Joe Johnson is, brother of the more famous Johnson, is saying that we won't have these no platforms anymore, and we won't have these trigger warnings anymore, in that same month, the university's minister is somehow allowing letters to be written to the heads of UK universities asking, you know, which of their professors are pro-Brexit and not. That is state intervention in the academy. That is censorship. A trigger warning is not censorship.
Exactly. And this is the idea of the censoriousness is something that needs to be integrated into a proper understanding of power, because the censor used to be like an actual institution, like an actual series of bodies which institutionalized state power, right?
Yeah.
And so the idea that an individual can be a censor, I think, is to enormously misunderstand the role of censorship historically in protecting power, which is obviously incredibly ironic, because people are most regularly accused of being censorious when using platforms, or when using tactics like no platform, and using tactics that maybe dispute the fact that say, you know, Vice should be having a very, very cozy interview with the woman from Britain First, who was just retweeted by Donald Trump. It's them who are being censorious.
Yeah,
you know?
it's the left and the liberal pansy students who are being censorious. But the question then is, what power are they trying to protect? What power has become overmighty that they're trying to protect? And it's clearly the fact that they want any power at all for themselves. The objection to the discourse of trigger warnings and trauma is clearly about wanting people, if they enter into the public sphere and they enter into the public conversation, young people, people of colour, women, queer people, they're allowed to come into that conversation as long as they don't change the conversation in any way. You know, as long as the conversation stays It stays scripted by a certain kind of person with a certain kind of power. That's the objection.
Yeah.
I think before we bring this to a close, I'd love us to talk a little bit about trauma and actually focus on how this language of trauma works. Because it is, I think you've probably noticed in the same way, how certain parts of the left will use words like making people unsafe, I feel unsafe, trigger warnings, the idea of trauma and how that has become, how that weaponizes is an overused word, but how the use of trauma politically has changed. Because I think this is something that an older generation doesn't really understand in the same way. When we're talking about pain and about feeling unsafe, people aren't always asking for that pain and that lack of safety to stop. They're calling attention to it. And this is just a personal theory for me. But and I was talking to a couple of university professors who are very, very concerned about trigger warnings lately. And what I said to them was, look, there is a certain... amongst our generation, and particularly those of us who are not white, straight men from privileged backgrounds, it's very hard to openly say, you know what, fuck you. You know what, this conversation is bullshit, I hate, and actually just stand up and shout back at your tutor. It's much easier to say to that person in a position of power, actually, this is hurtful. You have damaged me, you've damaged somebody else, and this is painful. And so sometimes when people say, this makes me feel unsafe, what they're actually wanting to say is you know, just fuck you. And yeah, it is. It's the same sentiment, but put in a slightly more almost polite way. But it might make more sense to that older generation if we'd asked you just to transpose all that into the key of fuck you.
I think this idea of performing in some senses like trauma publicly, and by performing I don't mean it's not true, but it's something that is on show, almost tactically for a political purpose. It's about pushing back on the quite sort of like masculine sort of norms of a political debate, right? The idea that in order to encounter reality sort of properly, and so that you can analyze it well, is to be totally unemotional and totally totally disinterested in the outcome of that speech, which is obviously nonsense if you do have skin in the game, but also has some continuities with the idea that with a long history of men censoring women from a position of power by pointing out the emotional tenor of their speech, by saying that you're hysterical, you're too emotional, aka that you haven't really analyzed this situation properly, but missing the point that to be emotional is precisely to analyze the situation properly.
Of course. And also, it's not that they're not, it's not that men in positions of power making these arguments are not emotional. It's that the women have somehow the wrong emotions. It's fear or upset. Those are the wrong emotions, but anger is a rational emotion when men have it, of course.
Yeah, only when men have it, of course.
And there is something, though, quite passive-aggressive about the trigger warning and the trauma conversation, as opposed to actively aggressive, which is what feels like what people really want from student radicals, although of course they don't. And I do think that's something about our generation, because we have grown up with such higher stakes for expressing anger and expressing emotion openly. Mm. We have learned, as people do within abusive situations, that to be passive aggressive rather than to be aggressive. And I don't think that's wrong. That's not censorious. That's something else. Maybe it would be better if people felt freer to just say, fuck you. But I think it's much better that we're talking about it in this way rather than not talking about it at all.
The idea of pointing towards the emotional suffering as a way of unleashing previously sort of veiled speech, like experiences that were previously sort of unconscionable by the public writ large, is to try and flip that dynamic on its head a little, to so that instead of this, you know, hysterical, irrational woman being calmed down by sort of, you know, hundreds of men on the internet, what it is like a very sort of rational person, someone who has correctly identified the structures of oppression that are surrounding them, being shouted down by like thousands and thousands of like completely rabid, irrational, terrified men. Like, there is a free speech issue.
Absolutely.
There.
It's just not the one you think.
Exactly.
You've been listening to The Sisterhood, a podcast from New Statesman. If you'd like to support our work, go online and subscribe at newstatesman.com. Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.